Hey, football fans, for those of you who can't get enough Baldy's Breakdowns, be sure to subscribe to Brian Baldinger's The Best Football Show. New episodes drop Monday through Friday, where Baldy breaks down the best games of the week. Be sure to subscribe to The Best Football Show on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Time now for the top of the order. The top three stories everybody will be talking about.
Following the saga of the radioactive material in parts of St. Louis, there is now apparently a high likelihood of radioactive waste in the smoldering landfill in Bridgeton. This is according to Missouri officials. Not good.
And also not great, a face of Cure Violence in St. Louis. He was an interrupter who helped interrupt violence in the city. It turns out he actually worked for a multi-state drug dealer and even helped coordinate murders for hire.
And SLU basketball with a win. You heard it here last night on KMOX. They beat LaSalle. The Blues will take on the Golden Knights tonight. Again, it is Amy Marks Kors and Chris Ranji. We are glad you are with us today. And Amy, we were talking about, we have actually talked a lot about the radioactive material in St. Louis. Last week, we had an interview with, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, with Nikki Budzinski, who represents a part of the Metro East, where there was an old Dow Chemical plant, which no longer, the building is still there, but that particular business is no longer there, but there's radioactive material there. Uranium and thorium was stored at that building. And a lot of that comes from the Manhattan Project.
Yeah, insane.
And the great majority of that radioactive material was delivered over to the Bridgeton area near the airport. And there are a couple of landfills that are pretty close to each other. Well, now apparently, and we're going to talk to Maria Kina on this story a little bit later on. KMOX has been covering this. The Missouri Independent has been on it as well. But apparently, from what I understand, it looks like they believe, Missouri officials believe, that some of that radioactive material is basically a little closer to the surface than they would like.
Yeah, and it is confusing. To be honest, Ranj, you and I have talked about this story. We've talked
a lot.
Allison Kite of the Missouri Independent, that does great work. And initially when we talked to Allison Kite, she had done a long form investigation with others that I think the story took me like 45 minutes to read. You know, it was one of those super long form pieces. It was brilliant. I know as a heads up, we will be talking to Katie Cull, St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporter, who's also been covering the story of the landfill. But you and I had maps out, like our phones, pulling up Google Maps.
Yeah.
Because the way like Bridgeton and Earth City and Maryland Heights and all of these areas being thrown out there in that conversation, because they all butt up against each other, I was a little confused with like what landfill I was looking at. You pulled up the Westlake landfill, and then very close to that is the Bridgeton landfill.
Yeah, I think there's a mistake in the way it's been presented, because both landfills are in Bridgeton.
Yes.
But there's a disposal area one and a disposal area two. They are right next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the radioactive waste they have believed for so long has been in the if you're looking at a map, just the northern landfill, which is really right on the same property. It's right there. Well, they believe that it is encroaching on the other one as well. And if you're wondering where exactly we're talking about, if you know where the Rams practice facility used to be, it's pretty close to that.
Yeah.
So out there, very close to Earth City, right off 70. So that's the area we're talking about, north of 70.
Yes, and as the Missouri Independent, like you explained, these two landfills that are situated in Bridgeton. So for the Bridgeton landfill, that's the one that you've heard in the news that has a subsurface smoldering event for more than 14 years. It's been emitting noxious odors.
Mm-hmm.
And as the Missouri Independent points out, raising concerns that this fire. It's not a, you know, it's a smoldering event where it burns like fire, but there's no oxygen. That this fire might reach the radioactive waste in the Westlake landfill. But the state in this letter that we'll be talking about today is saying there may be radioactive waste in the Bridgeton portion of the landfill far closer to the subsurface smolder than previously known. So, right, I think like if you had to draw a graph, we all know the story, we know the words, but it would be hard to draw the graph of which landfill and where's the smoldering event, and it's closer to the surface. And to me, Ranj, I think this should be the biggest story
in the area.
In the area.
Yeah, and I think the last time we talked about this, which was a couple of months ago probably, I said that. I said this is, I don't know if there's anything more important, really, truly, in the St. Louis area than this. Mm-hmm. A thing that has to be fixed because it is affecting the health of people. It is affecting lives. It will, and has already, killed people. Even if you cannot make the direct connection, there is going to be a cleanup effort. According to the EPA, they did announce that they're expanding excavation of the Westlake landfill, and because they have found additional radioactive contamination. So there are about 40 acres of the landfill that are going to be included in the cleanup, 20,000 cubic yards of contaminated soil, and it's going to cost upwards of $400 million. And here's the thing. Whatever it costs, you got to do it. If it's $1 billion, you got to do it. If it's $2 billion, you have to do it. There isn't anything more important because all of this contamination we talk about, everything in Bridgeton, the Westlake landfill, Coldwater Creek, what's happening in the Metro East, all of that is related.
Mm-hmm.
All of it. It is such a big story that covers a massive part of the St. Louis area. I think you're right. This absolutely should be priority number one. We talk a lot about improvements that need to happen in St. Louis, downtown in particular. And we're just talking about living, right? Like living spaces and shopping spaces and tourist places. But the real, true number one thing we should be focused on is fixing that.
And I think the timeline, yes, not only makes it confusing to follow, but also reveals just how many people are exposed to this radioactive material. So as you mentioned, Ranj, uranium was refined in downtown St. Louis for use in the Manhattan Project. After the war, they trucked all that waste to St. Louis County and dumped it at the airport where it leaked into Coldwater Creek. And if you see the barrels of this radioactive waste, like it's just leaking out of the barrels. They just trucked it over literally on flatbeds. And so it leaked into Coldwater Creek, which polluted the banks and the waters. This is something that's close to my family with friends who grew up playing in Coldwater Creek. And so many people have cancer or weird cancers and multiple members of the same family. Then the waste was sold and moved to a site in Hazelwood, which is still adjacent to the creek. It continued to expose residents. And in 1973, after valuable metals were extracted from the pile, the remaining waste was illegally dumped in the Westlake landfill. So it's just a trail of radioactive waste that's created a mess over a pretty big footprint and hurting a lot of people.
It's wild that stuff was even brought here. It was even brought to an area, and I get it that post-World War II, that part of St. Louis wasn't as developed as it is now. I understand that, but that's the kind of stuff that should literally be out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Right?
I think they thought it was the middle of nowhere.
There's no forethought that people would continue to expand and move west. I don't know how you don't know that. And you can make the argument that in the late 40s, they didn't know how harmful radioactive material was. I don't know how you couldn't know. How could you not at least foresee the possibility it was bad for people?
Yeah. Do you remember the girls in Nashville that were employees working under strict security protocols throughout the Manhattan Project, and they didn't know they were working with like radioactive waste. The Calutron girls, I think that's how you say it. The Calutron
is it,
girls.
Are you thinking of radium?
I know. I shouldn't have brought it up if I didn't have everything.
Okay.
I know they were called the Calutron girls, but Chris Wallace wrote about it in his book.
Oh, they were put on their teeth, right?
Yes, yeah, they didn't. 1945, I know what you're talking about. But they were working for the Manhattan Project, and all of them had issues for the rest of their life because they just didn't realize what they were working on. And so whether, I don't know, you know, how much of this was ignorance as to the lasting effects of radioactive waste, how much of it was carelessness.
Yeah.
But it is mind-blowing now. I mean, to see the barrels of radioactive waste, you would think it had to have been some form of a mix of ignorance and carelessness.
Well, what's interesting is if you go back over 100 years, they started using, if anybody has a mechanical wristwatch, or it doesn't have to be that, it could be a quartz wristwatch that glows in the dark when the lights go out. That's safe now. But over 100 years ago, they were using radium to paint the markings on the dials of a watch, not realizing that it was radioactive and hurting people.
So the Calutron girls were different because they were separating uranium isotopes. But it's the same idea of working with radioactive material. The radium,
that
was crazy. They would put it in their makeup.
They put on makeup. They put it in their watch. That's just, and you'd wear it on your body.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's unbelievable, the stuff that we used to do that was deemed safe,
or
they just had no knowledge of it.
The scientist Marie Curie, like, she died from her work with radioactive materials.
Again, but we're also talking like over 100 years ago. By the time you get to the late 40s, they should have known better. That's Amy Marks Kors. I'm Chris Ranji. Hey, St. Louis got a little bit of a shout out last night on national television, and every time it happens, boy, do we love to take advantage
of it. Well, St. Louis did receive a shout out on the Jimmy Kimmel show recently when St. Louis and Sterling K. Brown was on the show. Now,
he's good, man.
He's really good.
Big fan.
And he was talking about Emo's Pizza with Jimmy Kimmel. Now, Jimmy Kimmel, very familiar with Emo's Pizza because his wife is from St. Louis. And so they had a long exchange about Emo's Pizza and high school in St. Louis.
Chain in St. Louis called Emo's Pizza.
It's awesome. Don't say anything against it. What is your beef? Tell me.
No, you know that I don't like it?
I do know that you don't like it. It's a thin crust pizza. Is that your issue in and of itself?
The crust is the least of the problems.
Come on, give it to me.
This is something that I had an argument with John Hamm about this.
Yeah.
Anyone from St. Louis is so defensive of this pizza place.
It's delicious.
And I will tell you, I was excited to try it. In fact, I ordered it for my wife for Valentine's Day when we were first dating.
Okay.
I had it come out, and I was excited to try it because she says, oh, this is Emo's Pizza. It's the best pizza.
Yes.
And we tried it, and my first thought was, did I leave the plastic on it when I put it in the oven? And that is not a joke.
I believe you. You have to let it cool a little bit.
Okay.
I think you probably had it too, because sometimes the cheese will be running. If you let it cool for about 2 minutes, you would have a completely different culinary experience.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
I got your back.
Yeah.
That's what you do next time.
You're saying that if I were to try it cold instead of hot.
No, not cold.
The pizza.
I'm saying like not just right out of the oven, because sometimes the cheese needs to settle a little bit.
I feel like Emo's Pizza is my ayahuasca. You know what I'm saying?
It does something to you? Does something to the belly?
It's the cheese. It's the weird cheese, the Provel cheese.
It's delicious. Are you kidding? You really don't like it?
That's an understatement. Yes.
You prefer Chicago sort of pizza?
Definitely. Yeah. Right, no, I like New York. Well, you know, I mean,
New York is great too.
Yeah, no, I love Chicago pizza, New York pizza. I like pizza from Detroit, from whatever,
except
Emo's
for
Pizza.
Emo's.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. To each his own. I'm not going to fight you.
All right. Well, see, now, if this is your point, what about your wife? Does she like Emo's Pizza?
She loves Emo's Pizza.
Oh, see, another thing you guys can agree on.
We agree on a lot. We agree on more than we don't agree on.
Okay. All
right. But the big ones, you know.
All right. All right. Well, next time, maybe we'll try it together. I'll give it another shot.
That would make me very happy.
Okay. Very good. Sterling.
One more.
First thing I want to ask you don't like Emo's Pizza, do you?
It's the best pizza in the world.
Really bond.
So that was Jason Tatum at the very end there. All right, here's the thing about St. Louis style pizza. just in general. I think if you are coming from somewhere else and you've never experienced it before and you've eaten, you know, Chicago style, New York style, whatever it is, I always tell people don't go into it expecting it to taste like those.
Mm-hmm.
Expect something a little bit different. Like, really, don't go in thinking it's pizza. It is, but don't think that it's pizza, because if you do and you don't get mozzarella, yeah, you're going to think, what the hell is this? And that's why a lot of people from out of town don't like it.
Except the most important person from out of town likes it, because her husband, who is from St. Louis, loves it and introduced her to it. And that would be the greatest of all time, Simone Biles, likes Emo's Pizza.
She does?
She tweeted about it.
Oh.
Like 2 years ago, she tweeted about it because she got Emo's Pizza. Her husband, who plays for the Bears. And his name is?
Jonathan Owens.
Jonathan Owens introduced her to it. And when she tweeted about Emo's Pizza, I'm like, well, Jimmy Kimmel can, you know what?
Well, I'm,
because
look,
Simone Biles has given it her approval.
I love Emo's. I love St. Louis style. I grew up on it, though. I can imagine if I had not grown up on it, I can see myself not liking it. If I had just had all the other stuff first for years and years and years, and then I tried our style of pizza, I may not like it either.
I think what you said is right, that if you're from out of town, you're unfamiliar with it, and you are expecting a traditional pizza,
right,
you're going to be so thrown off, might take you a second. You know what it's like? It's like a new band. The first couple times you hear a song, okay. But it's once you get that familiarity with the band and you realize, oh my gosh, this is my favorite song of all time.
I think it's very similar to people who try the deep dish Chicago style at
which
first
is
because
tomato
the
pie, they say.
The sauce is on the top, the cheese is in the middle, and it's just very different. At first, it's startling. I don't know if you would like it.
Isn't it like lasagna? It's like lasagna without the noodles. It's like tomatoes.
It's thicker.
Yeah.
There's more cheese than normal. And they put the sauce on top as opposed to in the middle. It's really not any different than regular pizza. It's just kind of presented differently. Now, up there, the locals love to pride themselves in not liking the deep dish. They like a thing called tavern style.
Okay.
So it's pretty much a thin crust, thicker than what St. Louis is, but not quite deep dish. It's somewhere in the middle, and then they square cut it.
So
like
wait a minute.
Emo's does.
Deep dish is for tourists?
That's what they say, but I think they're full of crap.
Why would they invent something just for tourists?
Well, I don't think they invented it for tourists, but they just say that those are the only people who eat it. I don't agree with that, but that's what they like to say.
So is tavern...
Because I know that people who live there eat it, too. I think it's good.
Tavern style... Is that Chicago style or Chicago style deep dish?
The locals say that's what we eat. We eat that.
Is it close to Detroit style?
No. It's more like just regular pizza.
Got it.
Right?
I like Detroit style pizza.
You know what? So do I.
It's really good.
I totally agree with you.
And no one talks about it.
I know.
I actually hadn't heard of Detroit style until like 2 years ago, but I love it.
So there's is it Motor City? I think that's what it's called. It's in Brentwood. That's really good. Even Jet's Pizza is good.
Mm-hmm.
I love Detroit style pizza.
Big fan. I like
Caesars.
Most pizzas.
I don't really dislike pizza.
It's pretty good.
Dude, who invented it?
Bob Pizza.
Bob Pizza. Guy's a genius.
He should be a billionaire.
Also dead.
Hey. Obviously.
Chris and Amy show on KMOX. It is the first week of Donald Trump's second term as the President of the United States. So, well, we're glad to talk to this man. He is the author of The Big Truth, Upholding Democracy in the Age of the Big Lie, and two podcasts, The Takeout and Agent of Betrayal. Chief Washington correspondent for CBS News, it is Major Garrett with us this Thursday morning. How's it going, Major?
Fine. How is everybody?
Well, it seems like we're good. Pretty eventful days.
I just want to ask this, Ron. Yeah. So, was that like an intentional hidden joke, the immigrant song from Led Zeppelin?
We have to ask Matt Pajeski about
our
this one.
Our intrepid
Matt?
Producer.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Yes.
Okay, okay. Uh-huh. Because if there is any meta theme for the first week of the Trump administration. It is the immigrant song, the immigrant policies, the immigrant everything. Because they are sweeping, they are without precedent in our country in terms of reinterpreting either the Constitution or asylum or refugee policy, and they will be, the ramifications will flow and are already beginning to flow through our day-to-day lives and our economy. So, well played.
Thank you.
Well, he's very smart.
He is an incredible producer, Major. And along those lines, the specifics here, we've seen the grand sweeping statements about immigration. But as we stand today, are there people who are either undocumented or documented temporarily in schools or churches or other havens like that that could be arrested, taken into custody?
Or placed into potential deportation proceedings.
Yes.
So the places you described, schools, churches, to name two, have historically been viewed by both parties until now as sensitive places, places of some manner of sanctuary and protection, wherein their presence could be inquired about, but nobody would enter to try to take them out because they were in violation of immigration law. This administration has made it clear through an executive action that that's no longer the case, that these sensitive areas are no longer off limits. In addition, an executive order has said the existing interpretation of the 14th Amendment conferring citizenship to anyone born in the United States is not valid, and they intend to challenge it. They intend to challenge whether someone who is a parent, undocumented, or both parents are undocumented, and they give birth to a child in the United States, that child does not automatically become a citizen. This is under the understanding of birthright citizenship. Also, through executive action, the administration has effectively ended refugee status claims at the border or asylum claims. No one's claims will be considered at this moment. Everyone gets ejected. Everyone gets stopped, period. Now, there is existing U.S. law about what it means to qualify for refugee or asylum status. What the administration has said is we're not even going to pursue that process to see if you qualify. Nobody qualifies for anything right now. These things will be legally challenged for sure. There's also a deployment of 1,500 military personnel. Up to 10,000 could be deployed in the coming weeks to Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, California to reinforce border protection forces there. All of which is meant to deal with a problem that was certainly numerically visible and pronounced in the first 3 years of the Biden administration. There is no question about that. However, in the last 6 months, the number of illegal crossings at the border has dropped dramatically. In December and January, they were the lowest numbers recorded in more than a decade. And the aggregate number of illegal crossings in 2024 was lower than any year in the Trump administration, pre-pandemic. So if there was an invasion, and that's their words, not mine, you could possibly apply that to the first 3 years of the Biden administration, but not statistically to the last one. So all of these efforts and all of these personnel that are going to the border may, in fact, encounter far fewer people than anticipated.
Major, what has been the fallout of the basically the shutting down of any DEI programs or offices or anything in the federal government that these people have been told? I believe they're getting pay for a little bit and then they're essentially going to be out of work. So what's the fallout there?
We don't know numerically how many people this will affect. 10, 100, 200, nobody knows. Some of them will be allowed to transfer laterally within the federal government because they have civil service protection, meaning they can get to another job that this administration prioritizes. It does not prioritize diversity, equity, inclusion at all at any level. And it also wants to send an unmistakable signal to corporate America you better get rid of these programs. And if you don't, you're going to get something more than a side eye from us in the administration. So it's not a massive change to the federal workforce, which numbers about 2 million, but it is a symbolic gesture consistent with campaign promises to be hostile to any of the recent advocacy for either diversity, equity, or inclusion. The Trumpist Republican Party believes all of that is by its very nature discriminatory. The defenders of diversity, equity, and inclusion would say it's not discriminatory. It's just another factor to weigh in the process of evaluating employees, with a longstanding understanding that if you don't give people in underserved populations a chance to move up any ladder in employment by a merit system, they never obtain the seniority or the prominence to get higher positions, or it's much harder for them to do that. This is a clash of ideologies. It's a clash of workplace and personnel dynamics. But this administration is 100% opposed to the most recent incarnation of trying to create a more diverse workforce.
Major, I know there is a lot has happened since we last talked. But one of President Biden's last actions was seemingly unilaterally amending the Constitution when he declared that the Equal Rights Amendment was the 28th Amendment. Obviously, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Supreme Court Justice, loved the ERA, and she said it is not an amendment. What do you make of that odd declaration and what that means going forward?
It has no practical effect. Because when Congress set this process for ratification in motion, it set a deadline. And the deadline has long since lapsed. Yes, 2 or 3 years ago, I forget the exact number of years, Virginia was the state that took it over the two-thirds requirement for ratification, but it was well past the deadline. And that was the process by which this amendment was understood to work through. So it's an utterly symbolic thing. Biden could have done it in the first day of his presidency. He didn't do it. He did it the last because someone probably said, hey, why don't you do this? There's no harm, no foul. And in the grand scheme of things, there isn't anything that supersedes or is more controlling of existing federal law in terms of discriminatory policies, wage or otherwise. Very symbolic, odd, ill-timed and immaterial. I thought you were going to ask me about the family pardons, by the way.
Well, I have a long list. We can.
Okay. A lot of pardons to talk about.
Let's go ahead
here.
And do that.
Boy, do we do it. We do.
Yeah. So all right. Talk about the family pardons first.
Let's start with the family one. So I'm not at the White House every day. I go in there in and out periodically, but I'm not there every day. Ed O'Keefe, who was standing on the freezing cold balcony of the Cannon House office building all day and most of the night for our inauguration coverage. Yes, it was cold. Yes, it was 9 degrees. I'm still thawing out. Be that as it may, when that news came just before noon on inauguration day, and Ed O'Keefe is an experienced, hard-bitten reporter, kind of like me. Very few things surprise us. Very few things cause us to slacken our jaw in amazement. That did. He could not believe it. He was absolutely astonished that President Biden issued these blanket, sweeping, preemptive pardons for members of his broader family. I was too. But as someone who's at the White House every day and who deals with these people and gets their general orientation to things like that, he was stunned. And the country, I think, is stunned. And for Republicans who have long been discussing this possibility or this theory of a Biden crime family, there are things that can be questioned about relationships and consulting contracts that flow through family members of prominent politicians. Hello, that's basically been true almost our entire history. Republicans said there was something particularly egregious about the Biden family. They never brought it to the floor of the House. There was never an impeachment resolution. All of it was more conjecture than hard and fast evidence. But these pardons say, wait a minute. Maybe they were right all along. Why else would you preemptively pardon someone? And how can a president who tells the country over and over and over, I believe in due process and the rule of law, short-circuit entirely? Entirely. There isn't even an investigation. And there's a blanket pardon? That raises all kinds of questions. And if you don't think it didn't pave the way, either intellectually or ideologically, for President Trump to do what he did with the January 6th convicted felons and convicted trespassers, you're kidding yourself, because it did. And it gave Republicans plenty of talking points to say, well, whatever Trump did, Biden is worse. Whether you believe that or not, it created a rhetorical atmosphere where Republicans could say, bad on him, maybe bad on my guy, but it's bad all around and kind of a wash. And that's where we are.
In reality, though, they can use that. But in reality, do you think that's the case?
They're not morally equivalent. But I don't get to – that's my opinion. They're not morally equivalent, okay? But in a political atmosphere in which those who are on the Trump side believe there was excessive prosecution of people who trespassed, I don't believe that many Trumpers believe there was excessive prosecution of people who beat cops up. The president does. I don't think most Trumpers do. I think they have always had misgivings about that, and one of those people punished because they don't want to see cops beaten anywhere, least of all the United States Congress. But Trump did that. They're not morally equivalent. These people got due process. They pled guilty or were convicted by a jury of their peers. Full stop. However, when you so sweepingly exercise pardon powers as a president of the United States to protect your family and protect the Hunter Biden situation, not just for the crimes in which he was either convicted or pled, but reaching all the way back to when he started with Burisma, you are sending a signal that there is something about due process or something about the application of the law that you are materially afraid of when it comes to your family, and you are going to single them out for protection. That is a way of saying the law can't touch me and my family. That is a signal, not as disturbing, but plenty disturbing on its own.
Mm, yeah. Major, who is on the podcast this week?
So I have a little bit of news about that. This weekend will be the very last podcast episode of The Takeout.
Yes. How come?
Well, people are going to be disappointed.
They will. Now, if you listened to it on the radio last week, you heard this announcement that I made. And if you watch it on TV, on Paramount Plus or CBS News 24/7, you saw my announcement. All I can tell you is this. The Takeout, as a concept, as a show, as a process, is not dead. It's dying momentarily. There will be a new life. There will be an evolution. I can't explain everything yet, but in terms of the podcast and the radio show, it is ending. That was not my decision, but I was very much involved in the decisions made about its evolution. I'm less excited about the former and much more excited about the latter.
Interesting.
And Eric Posner, who is a brilliant legal mind at the University of Chicago, is our guest this week on the podcast, talking about the limits and the expanded definition of presidential power, not just under President Trump, but many other previous presidents.
So as soon as you're done here, can you go ahead and text us and tell us everything that's going on? And we promise not to tell anybody.
Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, stay tuned.
I thought it was because they heard about the whole idea to wear battery powered pants to the inauguration.
Boy, if the Secret Service would have let me have them, I could have really used them.
Especially walking in indoors with a bunch of wires attached to you, I'm sure would have gone well.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. All right. Well, we look forward to hearing what your next evolved endeavor will be.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you, Major.
Talk to you next week, Major Garrett.
See you. Bye-bye.
Major Garrett is the chief Washington correspondent for CBS News. Again, the Takeout podcast, last one this weekend. Better listen to it. Also, The Agent of Betrayal, a very good podcast, and his book, The Big Truth, Upholding Democracy in the Age of the Big Lie. It's Chris and Amy on KMOX.
Now, did you see this with Chris and Amy?
Amy, did you see that Netflix, your favorite streaming service, is raising prices again?
Yeah, I did.
They are doing it again. They had a record increase in the number of new subscribers for the last quarter of 2024. Their response is to start charging you more money, because of course they are. So
that's why I'm glad that it's not my. I don't watch a lot of movies. I know, shocking to everyone, or TV. And the TV I watch is overwhelmingly the Food Network. So YouTube is what I watch. YouTube TV. I haven't really been on Netflix in I don't know how long. But yeah, Netflix. I remember after COVID, when we all went back to our lives, they thought, well, this is terrible. We have to sustain this growth. You can't sustain the growth that you were able to create during a worldwide pandemic when everyone was forced to stay home and watch TV.
Well,
like, that's not a reasonable expectation
everything has to
for
be,
growth.
Everything has to be exponential. Can't you just have a little bit of growth and be happy with it?
That's why
man.
That's why you and I choose not to grow.
Dude, it's
every
just
day.
It's obnoxious. Yeah. If you use these services and you're trying to save money, everything's expensive as it is, and now they're going to raise prices. So a standard account with ads will cost you $8 a month. If you want the ad-free, it's now $18. Mm-hmm. The premium plan will now cost you $25 per month. And then you add that to everything else.
And more and more things were taken off of Netflix because, right, things go to the Peacock streaming channel or the Paramount or whatever it is.
Hulu and
So,
it's too much.
In other news, JetBlue said travelers can now use Venmo to book flights, making it the first carrier to accept purchases through Venmo. So the option to pay for flights with Venmo is now available on JetBlue's website. And it will roll out on JetBlue's mobile app in a few months. And you can also, like, if you're, you can scan a QR code at checkout, which would take you to Venmo. So you can, you know, buy aisle seats with Venmo and a linked bank account. So I like Venmo. I don't want to buy airline tickets on Venmo.
You can pay me on Venmo.
I get frustrated when people don't have Venmo.
Can pay me on Venmo, Amy, if you like.
No, I know, but I don't want to.
Yes, I'm saying you should.
Do you have Venmo?
Yeah.
Matt, do you have Venmo?
Yeah, right. Matt's got it.
A lot of people don't have it.
Yeah, so go ahead and send me whatever you feel. Whatever you feel. Whatever you feel comfortable with.
-$10.
You can't do -$10. Though you can
not
ask me for money.
Like
I'm not going to give you any money, but you can give me some if you want.